Welcome to The Laptop Lifestyle. I'm your host, Alexis Teichmiller, digital content creator for brands and companies and online entrepreneur. Whether you're running a business full-time, starting a side hustle, or just beginning to think about starting a business, you are in the right place. The Laptop Lifestyle is for you, the unconventional thinker, the person who isn't afraid to step outside of their comfort zone and pursue creativity over complacency. Each week, we will unlock how to build passionate online communities and thriving online businesses. All right, Laptop Lifestylers, let's jump in.
Hello, hello, Laptop Lifestylers. It is your host, Alexis Teichmiller here, and I am just jazzed to have our next guest on the podcast. But first, I want to apologize if I kind of sound like a man. I'm getting over a cold flu thingy. Yeah, that's a scientific term, thingy. And so I apologize if I sound a little congested, but I promise I won't sound congested on this interview. How many of you guys love travel? I'm obsessed with travel. I feel like a massive part of the Laptop Lifestyle is travel. And today on the show, we have Gary Arndt, and he is an award-winning travel blogger and travel photographer who has been traveling around the world literally since 2007. Y'all, his travels have taken him to 190 countries and territories in the Traveler's Century Club and 120 United Nations countries. He has visited hundreds of World Heritage sites and all 50 U.S. states. His blog, Everything Everywhere, is widely considered one of the most popular travel blogs in the world. In 2010, Time Magazine named it one of the top 25 blogs on the internet. And the internet is a pretty big place, you guys. And it earned a gold medal in the travel blog category in the North American Travel Journalists Association Awards. In this episode, this episode is filled with so much wisdom. Gary is, he is just so wise. We talk about the importance of building authority in order to have true influence, why Gary loves traveling to off-the-grid locations, and how travel has changed his life. This episode, I don't know, I might say this about every episode, but I think this is one of my favorite episodes. So I hope I'm not talking this up too much, but it's pretty powerful. So before we jump in, can you guys do me a favor? Can you screenshot your podcast player right now on your phone and then go over to Instagram and upload it to your stories and tag me in it? I love connecting with you guys. And a massive reason why I created this podcast is so that I could connect with other Laptop Lifestylers like you on social media and just kind of keep up with each other and honestly just connect, which is one of my favorite things to do. All right, guys, let's dive into the show with Gary Arndt. Hey guys, this is Alexis, host of the Laptop Lifestyle Podcast. I am here with my new friend, Gary Arndt. He is an award-winning blogger and travel photographer who's been traveling around the world since 2007. Guys, he has been to over 190 countries and territories, all seven continents. This guy's amazing. He has a top travel blog called Everything Everywhere. And Gary, I'm just stoked to have you on the show. I feel like there's so much I can learn from you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Of course. So I want to take it back. I want to take it way back to 2007. How did you even get into this space?
By accident.
Of course.
So growing up, my family never traveled anywhere. I'd never really been out of the country. I never saw saltwater till I was 21 years old.
Oh, wow.
In the early 90s, I was at the right place at the right time. And I started a very early internet company. We were doing website database integration before it was kind of a thing. My college roommate wrote a program called Cold Fusion, which is now owned by Adobe. And it was one of the very first ways to integrate a website with a database. This was before PHP. This was before MySQL. This was even before really Linux became a thing. So this is even before like Firefox or, you know, Netscape. It was the Mozilla browser from the University of Illinois. That's really what it was.
And wait, are you from Illinois?
No, Wisconsin originally.
Oh, okay. Because I'm from Illinois and I grew up very close to the U of I. So that's why I just had to jump in and ask.
No, but that's where Mark Andreessen was from, and he really kind of built the first web browser. So this is, I remember having arguments about using the table tag because it wasn't fully supported, to give you an idea. So this is like 93, 94, really early on. And so I was out of college, and my friend was building this product that became very successful, and some companies wanted to have their websites built with it so they could integrate like a catalog and do things like that.
Right.
And so he said, well, do you want to do this? Because he didn't want to actually do the work. He wanted to focus on the product. So I was like, sure. So I started doing it. I had a jewelry store as my first client. And then more companies were interested. So I got a friend who had a friend. Next thing you know, we're building, you know, data-driven websites for brokerage houses, newspapers, big telecommunications companies. Wow. And 4 years later, I had 50 people working for me. And managed to sell the company before the dot-com bubble burst. And so I was 28 years old when I sold it. And I started a couple other companies. We bought some software from the University of Minnesota that we ended up starting another company that was a business intelligence software company. Started a network of video game websites that actually did really well for a while until the dot-com bubble burst. And then I kind of hit a point where I just didn't know what to do. So I went back to school for 3 years, studied geology and geophysics because I just wanted to do it.
Yeah.
Realized that I didn't want to get a PhD because I saw everything that was happening with the PhD students. And I concocted this idea of traveling around the world. And in 1999, after I sold my company, the company I sold it to was a multinational company. And I conned them into sending me around the world to talk to their regional offices about web development because they hadn't really been focusing on that before. So I did a 3-week whirlwind tour, went around the world, stopped in Tokyo, Taipei, Singapore, Paris, Frankfurt, Brussels, and London.
In 3 weeks?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So like I said, it was a whirlwind tour. First time I'd ever really been out of the country, and I got to see all sorts of stuff. And that really stuck with me for several years. And so I came up with this idea in 2005 of selling my house and traveling around the world for a year or two. So it took me a while. The housing market was really soft. I sold my house. And in 2007, I set out, told everyone I'd be gone for a year, but I was really thinking 2 years. And it kind of just never ended. I started a website when I set out to sort of update my friends and family, and it kind of took off. There weren't a lot of people doing it at the time. Right. I could kind of tell you the names of all the other travel bloggers because there were so few of them, and it's become huge since then. That's kind of how it got started.
Wow, that is incredibly interesting. Were you scared at all to just go off on your own for 2 years and travel? Like, was there any kind of anxiety or fear, or were you just ready?
No, and I get this question a lot, and in hindsight, maybe I guess I should have, but I wasn't. I just kind of did it. That's the way I've always been. If I wanted to do something, I would just go and do it. But yeah, I can understand why people, you know, kind of have trepidation, but I never really thought about it that way.
Yeah. I mean, that's incredibly inspiring. I do a lot of female solo travel. And so hearing you talk about this is very inspiring and encouraging to me because it's something that's really important to me and a lot of my listeners as well. So you started a blog, and was this kind of before you even knew what the blog could be, that you could, you know, use it to sell services, that you could showcase your work? Like, how did it turn into what it is now?
Gradually. That's the best way to put it. So I was...
Oh, you mean, Gary, you mean it wasn't an overnight success?
No. To go back, I had done this network of video game websites. And at our peak, we were doing approximately 50 million page views a month. So These were real, and this included like, you know, forums for very popular games like Counter-Strike. At the time, EverQuest was a big thing. So we had like the top EverQuest site and the top Counter-Strike site. So I had a good idea of what a lot of traffic was. And my blog was not doing a lot of traffic. I could tell you the names of everyone going to my website. And having a business background, I was about 9 months into my trip and I was in Hong Kong. And I remember saying to myself, you know, this is either a waste of my time and I should stop worrying about the website, or I should try to make something of it, without knowing what that something of it was, because there was no model to base it on.
Right.
And so I basically, I went to a newsstand and I bought every magazine and I went through it and I set up a spreadsheet and I did an analysis of what was in all the magazines and figured out that photography was a big part of it. And that the number of countries mentioned in editorial comment content in each magazine was like 35 per issue, which was crazy because people don't visit 35 countries in a month, let alone in their life. So, you know, why were people buying these magazines? And I realized it was basically travel porn. That's why people were doing it. And, you know, I realized images were important. So I started putting an image on my website every day. For over 8 years, I posted a photo to my website every day. And not only was it a form of content, but it forced me to become good at what I was doing because I was making my work public. And the only way not to be embarrassed was to get better at what I was doing. And so I quickly got better at travel photography to a point where I went from being an absolute novice who never owned a camera in 2007 to being named a travel photographer of the year by the Society of American Travel Writers in 2014.
Wow. That is so inspiring. So here's what I want to dig in on is this idea that you started out knowing nothing, kind of, you know, an amateur photographer, and then you turn around and now you win awards. I think a lot of people don't dive in on new ideas or dreams of theirs because they're scared that they won't be good enough or they're scared to fail until they're good. You know, what advice do you have for people that are scared to jump in because they're scared of being bad at something?
Well, everyone sucks at everything when they start. I mean, that's reality, right? You know, Yo-Yo Ma was horrible at the cello the first day. LeBron James probably couldn't dribble the first time he held a basketball. If you go to my website, go to the travel photos and look my first photos under from Hawaii. They're all there. I've kept everything there. And they are the most god-awful photos in the world. In fact, everything from like the first 2 years I was traveling, I'm really embarrassed that I wouldn't probably display it, you know, now, but they're there. And it was an incremental process. And I remember looking back at photos that at the time I thought was good. And now I just think they're awful, but it's an incremental process. You always just have to kind of get better. It's a little bit at a time. And I think what kills people is, you know, you can look at someone at the top of their game and say, well, I'm not them. I'm not going to start. Well, of course not. But the process from getting from A to B involves a lot of time and a lot of incremental improvement, just changing a little bit, all the time, all the time. And that's how success works for anyone.
Yeah, that's something I always say is whether you're going an inch or a mile, movement is movement. And so as long as you're taking a small step every day towards that thing that you want to do, even if you suck at it at first, it's better than doing nothing. Have you ever had any like massive creative funks? I mean, posting a photo every single day, showing up, really, you showed up on the internet every single day for 8 years. Did you ever go through any creative funks or times where you were really discouraged or you're traveling, you know, alone? Like, how did you fuel yourself whenever you were lacking that motivation?
It's not creativity. The nice part about travel photography is a lot of that is taken care of by the place you're at. If you're in a place that's beautiful, you'll be able to take beautiful pictures, right? You're capturing what's there. You're not like a painter that has to create something from scratch. You're capturing what's around you.
Right.
After a while, so my website will be 12 years old this October. So I stopped doing the daily photo a couple of years ago. I think it had achieved what it had set out to do. And so I became better as a photographer. I think I'm okay now.
I think you're pretty good.
And it was also kind of hurting me in other respects, like with Google. Just putting up a photo with no text, just a caption was kind of, I think, hurting me. So I kind of changed gears. I don't think it's you're in a funk creatively. A lot of times it's just being tired. And I think that's what a lot of people don't understand about traveling for a very long period of time is they think of their travel as, oh, I go on vacation. But that is, I go somewhere, you do something, you come back. And I remember when I first started traveling, I was, so the first place I went, I kind of started going west, and I took 6 months to cross the Pacific Ocean. I was island hopping to all these little island countries in the Pacific. And I remember being in Hawaii at the very start of it. So this is not even a month in. And it dawned on me, I can't go home. I sold my house. This is it, where I am tonight. And it took me a few months to get over that, because that's always in the back of your head when you're traveling, is that you have a place to go home. Mm-hmm. And so I was on the road for 9 years straight. I finally got an apartment again. I kind of got burned out being on the road full time. And now I travel about half the year, but I have a place to go back between trips. But mm-hmm. but even that was an adjustment, because I got so used to being on the road for almost a decade that when I came back, I found myself, you know, I just got a bed and I've been in this place for 2 years. Like I would.
What were you sleeping on?
A couch. Okay. you know, I just, it didn't really dawn on me. I ate out almost every meal when I first, you know, came back. It took me a while to start cooking for myself again, but yeah, there was a lot of adjustment on both ends of it, both starting out and then kind of coming back from it.
So you were on the road for what, you say 8 or 9 years? 9 years?
9 years straight, yeah. And then the last 2 years I've had a place that it's nice because it gives me a steady work environment. I have a mm-hmm. proper 27-inch monitor that I can edit photos on. I have a gigabit internet connection. I'm talking to you. You know, I do a lot of podcasts, so I have a proper microphone set up. All of this would have been impossible beforehand, because doing it out of hotel rooms, you know, sometimes you don't even have a desk to work on. You have a bad right. internet connection, and it's always changing, and it's usually changing in a manner that is crappy in some way.
Yeah, I've definitely been there with the sucky hotel Wi-Fi. So during the first couple of years of you being on the road, how were you making money? How were you sustaining yourself?
I wasn't making money. I didn't make any money on my website for 5 years. I had sold a business. I had sold my house. So it wasn't something that I really needed to make money at right away. And okay. when you're traveling, a lot of people don't realize this. It's a lot cheaper in a lot of ways than living a normal life. You're not paying rent. You're not paying property taxes. You're not paying utilities. You're not paying for gas in a car. You know, most of the expenses in life are cut out. And what you are paying, depending on what part of the world you're in, are often much less. So if you're in Southeast Asia, Central America, places like that, it can be quite affordable. So I wasn't really spending a lot of money, and I had quite a bit of savings. And I also really didn't care about making money. I know a lot of people, when they start out, they wanted it, the first thing they think about was making money. And what I realized was, if I build an audience, the money will eventually come to me.
Right.
And so that was what I focused on first, build an audience. And then when that day comes that I'll want to start making money off this, it'll be pretty easy.
So what were your first steps into making, you know, money or making an income from your blog? You know, you said that you waited, or it took you 5 years to earn an income, which I love that, because it shows the everyday or yearly struggle when it comes to building an online business. I feel like so many times people look at blogging and at online entrepreneurship kind of in an aspirational lens of, I want to do that, but then there's not that reality of how much work it really takes. So what was that first jump into making an income from your blog?
I began it by doing some of the very first brand ambassadorships and endorsements in the travel industry. So because I had, I should kind of explain my philosophy towards this. And it's a little bit different from a lot of people. A lot of people, you know, they got their blog and their website and they're focused on the SEO and doing the conversions and all that. And there's nothing wrong with any of that. That's perfectly fine. But my approach has always been one of an authority approach, meaning I want to be known as an authority. So I want to be, you know, I've spoken at pretty much every major conference in the travel industry. I'm regularly quoted in major media publications. Like this morning, I was in USA Today, which got syndicated out to like 50 different local news websites around the country. I'm regularly in the Washington Post, things like that. So my approach hasn't been like a nuts and bolts sort of, you know, technical SEO kind of way, but kind of a bigger picture way of authority, where you're getting super high quality links and mentions, which makes it also a lot easier to gather an audience, say, on social media, and then also a lot easier to do these things like brand ambassadorships.
Okay. I love that philosophy too, by the way. So tell me how you jumped into the brand ambassador.
I should add that approach takes a lot more time, because it's not easy, but if you can pull it off, I think it pays for itself in the long run, because, you know, Google can change their algorithm tomorrow. Facebook changes it every week. You know, they've screwed people over that have built businesses on that platform. But if people just know who you are and you're mentioned a lot, that's something that can't be taken away very easily. And right. You develop a much stronger following from people by taking that approach.
I love that. So you jumped into the brand ambassadorship. Were you partnering with travel agencies or hotels? Like, what did that look like and how did you jump into that? And then I know there are a lot of people that listen to the podcast now who are in that travel space and they're wanting to partner with brands. You know, walk through how that whole process works. And then, you know, what are some tactics when it comes to working with brands or pitching yourself?
You know, the first thing is I say no to pretty much every business offer that comes across my inbox. Because most of them, I only want to work with really reputable companies. So who I work with is a reflection on me. And the flip side of that is for the company, who they work with is a reflection on them. So the first one came about in 2010. Bruce Poon Tip, who is the founder and owner of G Adventures, they're the largest adventure travel company in the world. They have a brand and a company that fits really well with what I do. Small group adventures, they go to Antarctica, they go to Bhutan, they go to, you name it, like 120 countries around the world. Very, very up my alley in terms of the type of travel I do. So they launched a very early influencer program back in 2010, and I was part of the first group, and I still work with them today. They just relaunched their program last week, and I'm still working with them. And that has been one. And then I've also done stuff with Scotty Vest. I've done stuff with Allianz Insurance, and they're, you know, one of the largest insurance companies in the world. And then I've done smaller projects with a bunch of different destinations and tourist boards and things like that. But I try to limit it to well-known brands or larger companies and not startups and apps and things like that.
Right. And then for people that want to jump into that, how do you even go about finding the right brands that you would want to work with?
You don't jump into it. So really, again, and so it goes back to who do they want to work with? And the larger, more reputable company want to work with people with larger audiences who have developed a reputation. And it goes right back to this issue of authority. So I do some blog coaching for travel bloggers. And this concept of authority is the thing I really hammer home the most. Like, you need to develop things because you have a story, right, that you need to tell. And how you tell that story to people is kind of an explanation of the authority you have. So I've been working with one guy who has a scuba website. He started out with like, I'm a digital nomad. I'm like, no. You love scuba diving. That's all you ever talk about. Make a scuba site. And so we set out a plan. It's like, okay, who are the big names in the scuba industry? Well, there's Patty. There's the Diver Action Network, and there are all these, you know, different things. I'm like, all right, let's get relationships with these companies. And over a period of like 2 years, he did that. And he set up relationships with all these major companies. And then it's like, okay, well, how do you prove to someone that you're an authority in diving? So when you started out this show, you introduced me. You said, well, Gary's been to 190 countries and territories. He's been to all seven continents. And that's a way of... that's kind of a quantitative sort of proof that says, okay, this guy's traveled a lot.
Right.
I've won several awards, you know, a whole bunch of awards for travel photography. Now, this is a podcast, so no one listening to this is actually going to see any of my photos. But if they're listening to this, they'll probably say, okay, he's probably a pretty good photographer. So you need to have certain things like that, I think, which are more than just a wishy-washy, I really love traveling and I believe it's a, you know, anybody can say that. You need some hard something that indicates what you are. So some of the people I've worked with, what they've done is they've created like a top 100 list. So my scuba friend, I said, so make a list of the top 100 dive sites in the world and go dive them all. Now that's a big project. That's going to take several years.
Right.
But within 2 months of having set the list, he was on television talking about it. He was getting invitations from countries to have him come and dive because they wanted to promote their dive because they weren't, you know, people didn't think of him that way. I had another couple that have a blog. They listened to me give this speech at a conference, and then they set about saying, okay, we're going to create the top 100 adventure tours, and we're going to go do them. And that's exactly what they did. And so they have a talking point, and they have something that they can reference and say, look, this is what makes me an authority. And so if you want to work with brands, I think you need to have something which you can point to say, this is why I'm an authority. And there are other ways to do it as well. You don't certainly have to do that. G-Adventures now, for example, is working with some people that have shows on the Travel Channel. You know, you can use large media companies and do an association with them and let some of their authority rub off on you. But I do think you need to have something, not I have a lot of followers or I have a lot of traffic, because we all know there are ways to do that are fishy and, you know, whatnot. You need something a bit more tangible and a bit more solid that you can hang your hat on that proves you have some very serious authority in whatever it is you want to talk about.
This is such great advice. Thank you for diving into that. That is extremely helpful for listeners and for myself as well. You were talking a lot about this idea or this tactic, really, and the importance of building authority and being an authoritative kind of thought leader in whatever space that you're in. How do you feel about all these influencers coming out who may or may not really truly have real audiences? They might have bought likes or followers, or like, how do you feel about how the blogging industry has taken a turn down this more influencer vanity kind of direction? I'm just curious on your thoughts on that.
There are some people, well, first of all, when we are for the most part talking about people on Instagram.
Right.
So there are some people that might be like a Snapchat influencer or something like that, but I think that's kind of dying. So talking about people with large Instagram followings, and there was a time several years ago where you were able to get crazy number of followers doing all sorts of weird things. If you use a certain hashtag, you got a bunch of followers from bots and whatnot. You didn't necessarily buy them, but there were ways you could do it. Instagram used to promote people. They used to have certain accounts that they would promote. And if you were lucky enough to be one of them, then, you know, score, because you got super popular, you got a large following. One of the things I would always recommend, and I think the whole Instagram influencer thing is going to, we've seen peak Instagram. I'm not saying it's going to die, but I'm saying we've seen the peak of how big the Instagram influencer is going to be. And there's a couple reasons for this. One, an Instagram like is the lowest form of engagement, I think. So if you look at how long of an attention you get when someone likes a photo on Instagram, you're looking at a second, maybe two, three, if you're lucky.
Right.
So how long, you know, is someone going to listen to this podcast that we're listening to that we're on right now? Half hour, 45 minutes at least. So in terms of the amount of time, you know, someone listening to this podcast is going to hear your voice. They're going to have a deeper idea of who you are. And so they're going to probably care about you more than if they just liked a photo on Instagram. So I think people are realizing that there are deeper forms of engagement. So when you look at a podcast stats, the big stat that everyone uses is downloads, mainly because we got nothing else, right? So use downloads. And so the base unit of a podcast is a download. The base unit of Instagram is a like, but they're in no way, shape, or form similar, because one like in terms of time and attention may be worth, you know, thousands of likes equals one podcast download. And I think people are wising up about this. People initially just wanted large, gaudy numbers. And that was kind of the first wave of social media. We're still not past that. I saw it on Twitter and Facebook, and it's on Instagram right now, where they just want big numbers and they don't care about where the numbers came from or what they represent or anything else. But at the end of the day, you're going to need to have a deeper level of engagement. And that comes from longer blog posts, email newsletters, podcasts, Facebook groups. You know, I have a Facebook group that has about 4,000 people. My Facebook fan page has 122,000 people. And I would give up my fan page in a heartbeat for my group because there's way more engagement in my group. And that deeper engagement is really what matters. And so it's things like that that are going to matter, I think, going forward. You know, the thing I've always said is, you know, real influence is the ability for someone to buy you a beer when they're in, when you're in their city.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I really agree with your thoughts on that, especially because I'm in the email marketing space. So I see the power of email over social media, but I've also seen people kind of abuse their social media influence or not take it as seriously. And so my next question is, when you do have influence and you do have that authority that you were speaking about, what kind of responsibility comes with that? It's not just you can say whatever you want or, you know, get people to buy something that you don't stand behind. Like, there has to be some kind of responsibility behind that influence.
Yeah. So if people are really good at smelling BS and knowing if someone is a sellout, I don't think that's hard for most people to figure out. And if you're shilling a brand new product every single day, people kind of know that. And I think you're going to lose your audience. You're going to lose your authority. People aren't going to, they don't want to listen to a veiled ad every time they go to your account. But at the same time, I think people realize that people have to make money, that there's nothing wrong with promoting a product or a brand if it makes sense. And I think that's the key. So you're not going to see me touting a watch or sunglasses or things like that, unless there's a really strong tie-in with like travel, because otherwise it just wouldn't make sense. And quite frankly, I wouldn't use the product. So if you really, you know, and I think you just have to have that sort of integrity. If it's not something you would use, if it's not something you really don't believe in, then don't do it. And I think there was a, oh, who's this guy in YouTube that just had the big backlash? Logan something.
Oh, Logan Paul.
Yeah. I never heard of the guy until this happened. But doing like the dumb stuff he's done, I mean, I think a lot of people, they get, you know, popular, they develop this audience, and kind of, you see the same thing with certain celebrities where they then start behaving in a way such that they think there's no, you know, they can do anything they want. There are no repercussions, no, you know, consequences to any of their actions. And that's ridiculous. And I have seen a lot, just in the world of travel blogging, which in the big scheme of things is not a big deal. Just people act like real divas and have these ridiculous demands. And, you know, they don't have big websites. They don't have big followings, yet they somehow think that the world owes them something. I think if nothing else, you should certainly try to stay humble.
100%. How have you, as your blog has grown, as you know, your Instagram has grown, as your business has grown, what have been, I guess, benchmarks or things that have helped you stay humble?
I think, you know, there's a, I've heard celebrities talk about this, that, you know, the way you are when you kind of develop some success is kind of the way you're going to be after you become successful. Mm-hmm. And there are certain celebrities that you'll always hear rumors about who are just really nice. They're nice to everyone they meet. They're nice to their cab driver. You know, they tip well. And then there are some people who are just jerks. And I think that's kind of the way it works online too. That there are some people that develop, you know, some success and they're really nice and they are really humble. And it's not just in travel, but in other, I'm sure you've met other, you know, influencers at conferences and things like that. And, you know, everyone kind of knows who they are. Everyone wants to meet them and they're real nice. And then there are other people who are just, you know, think they're so important. And I don't really know if there's a way to, you know, either you're kind of humble to begin with, or you have a certain sense of humility, or you don't. And yeah, I really don't know what else there is beyond that.
Yeah. I think there has to be some level of personal awareness. Like if you're aware of yourself and, you know, how you feel and how you make others feel, I think that's a good way to keep your ego in check. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think you also have to realize, you know, what you're doing in the big scheme of things is not that big of a deal.
Right. Right. Yeah.
You know, internet famous is not famous. Not really.
Yeah.
I remember having a discussion about this with someone, and we were sitting in a park in San Francisco, and the subject got on Tim Ferriss. And I think if you're in various online worlds, most people know who Tim Ferriss is. Very successful book, podcast, etc. So we just randomly asked a couple people sitting around us, do you know who Tim Ferriss is? Nobody knew who he was. So, you know, everyone thinks, oh, wow, Tim Ferriss is, you know, a real pop. Well, yeah, in certain circles, but, you know, in the greater world, not necessarily.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of based on the world that you're in. Like Casey Neistat is our keynote speaker at Craft and Commerce, which is ConvertKit's conference this summer. And I've told a few of my friends, I'm like, oh yeah, Casey Neistat is going to be the keynote. And they're like, who's that? You know, he's got over 9 million YouTube subscribers. Like he's huge in the YouTube space, but you take one tiny step outside of that space and, you know, it kind of makes you extremely humble.
Well, here's the other thing. And I've told people this, do you know who Anthony Bourdain is?
Yes.
Okay. So you know who he is. Do you watch his show?
I do not.
Okay. Good answer. Most people are in the same boat. They know who he is, but they don't necessarily, and there's a lot of celebrities like that, right? I remember growing up and Charo was on the Hollywood Squares. And for years, I didn't know why Charo was famous, other than she was famous for being famous. I eventually went and looked it up on Wikipedia. She's actually a really good Spanish guitar player. I didn't know that. But with traditional media, we can be exposed to things. So if you're watching CNN, they'll have an ad for Anthony Bourdain's show. Or if you're on a talk show, he might be on it. Or there's some reference to it. Like, I don't know anything about the Kardashians. I've never watched their show. I don't pay attention. But I know they exist. And I'm constantly bombarded with Kardashian stuff, even though I don't really want to hear it.
Same.
So there's this like core, which is like actually consuming their product. And then there's this much larger penumbra around it, which is like you're exposed to who they are, even though you don't know much about it. Online, that doesn't really exist. Either you consume the core product or you probably have no idea who that person is, right? So there are, you know, and in Casey Neistat may not actually be a good example because he's been on CNN and some other, you know, major media things,
right.
But there are YouTube celebrities that are in, you know, like tens of millions of subscribers who the vast majority of the public have absolutely no idea who they are, because unless you are looking at that channel, they're not anywhere else that you would see them.
Right. That's a really good point.
I think that's one of the biggest difference. Yeah. Between being, you know, famous and online famous.
famous or online famous. I like the description there. I want to take advantage of the fact that you've been everywhere and you've traveled everywhere. And I want to ask you, what has been the biggest lesson that travel has taught you?
I think everyone in the world is kind of the same. They want the same things. They want to live their lives. They want to live their lives. They want to raise their kids. They want to go to work. Yet when most people think of the outside world, if they haven't traveled, they see the world as a dangerous place, because the only time they ever hear about a place is when something bad happens. Mm-hmm. So their association is always going to be negative with almost everything. And, you know, the example I always use is the country of Colombia. When I ask most people what they think of Colombia, what the first thing that comes to mind is it's drug lords. Well, that's from like Miami Vice and stuff in the 80s. You know, they haven't had that problem there. You know, Pablo Escobar died a long time ago, you know, a couple decades. That's not a thing in Colombia anymore. Colombia is a relatively safe country. It's very nice to visit. But there has been nothing that has replaced the drug lord idea in everyone's mind. So they still have that negative perception because nothing ever replaced it. You know, they don't get on the news and say, today in Colombia, everything is great. You know, that's just not a thing.
Right.
When I went to Vietnam, the thing everyone asked me was, you know, about the Vietnam War, because that's all they know about Vietnam. Mm-hmm. The United States had a war there. The end. They don't know anything about the country that happened beforehand. They don't know anything what's happened since. All they know is the Vietnam War, and that's it. And then there are some countries where nothing has ever really happened. You know, Oman, really great country to visit, but nothing has ever really happened there. So people just don't even know about it, if they even know it exists at all. They may know it's in the Middle East, and the Middle East is dangerous.
Right.
But, you know, there's never been any terrorism in Oman or anything. And so they may paint it with a broad brush, but other than that, they would be completely ignorant of the place. And that's how we view a lot of the world. And so what ends up happening is people kind of all go to the same place. So Paris is overcrowded, Barcelona is overcrowded, Bangkok is overcrowded, because, you know, they go to the places that they hear about, and they don't know about the other places because they just don't know about it. They've never heard of it. They've never had friends that went there. And so there are some incredible places all over the world that are really under-touristed, and a few places that just are swamped with people.
Right. Do you prefer the more remote, you know, non-touristy destinations?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, I should say a lot of the popular places are popular for a reason. You know,
right.
The pyramids are the pyramids. You know, Rome is Rome. It's pretty cool. I'm not saying you shouldn't go to those places, but there are some really great places. Let's take, for example, Rome. So a lot of people will go there. They do their bus tour. They do whatever. They go to the Vatican. They go to the Colosseum. They don't know that 45 minutes away in the hills is the city of Tivoli, which has the villa of the Emperor Hadrian with all sorts of stuff still there. All of these fantastic sculptures and statues that are lining the property. There's also a fantastic villa there from the Renaissance period that was one of the greatest water gardens ever made. Still functioning. All the fountains and stuff. It's an amazing place. Go 45 minutes in the opposite direction towards the sea, and you can go to Ostia Antica. And Ostia was the port city for Rome. So all of the goods from all the world that came to Rome came through Ostia. And the city, for the most part, is still there. It's like going to Pompeii. You can see the vendor stalls. You can see the toilets. You can see the streets. And nobody goes there. And these places are very close. People just aren't aware of them.
So how do you encourage people to get outside of the touristy attractions and kind of go off-gridding? Because that's something that I do a lot, is I don't like to just go do the touristy things. I like to stay in local areas, specifically Airbnbs. I like to shop at local markets. Like, I want to be more immersed in the culture. And then I have the locals tell me what they would enjoy. Like, how do you encourage people to do the same or kind of get outside of their comfort zone?
Well, first of all, I don't rely on locals, because locals are not tourists in their own city.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, a lot of native New Yorkers have never been to the Statue of Liberty. And I find this true everywhere. So I grew up in Wisconsin. I've never been to Frank Lloyd Wright's studio, which is in Wisconsin. And one of these days, I'm going to do it. But I never feel it's urgent, because
you always have access to it. Yeah.
Exactly. And so a lot of people, you know, if you're in Florence, you know, it's like, oh, I live in Florence. I'm going to go see David. And I'm going to go, you know, no, they don't do that. Right. That's for tourists. So I think a lot of it is simply awareness. A lot of people just don't know what's out there. And a lot of the guidebooks and whatnot are designed to do what is popular. You know, there are certain places that I've come to champion because they get no visitors. And one of the best examples is Nahanni National Park, which I'm guessing you might not have ever heard of.
No. Tell me more.
Yeah, it's in the Northwest Territories of Canada. And I've been to a lot of national parks all over the world. It might be the greatest national park in the world. It gets 800 visitors a year. No, most Whoa. Canadians don't even know about it. When they came out with the very first World Heritage Sites ever in 1978, the Galapagos Islands were on it. Yellowstone National Park was on it. You know, a lot of really great things. And Nahanni. And yet no one knows about it, because it's in a remote location. There are no roads, so you have to fly in. So it is admittedly difficult and kind of expensive to get to, but it really is one of the most amazing places on earth. And so I try to talk about it whenever I can. And I've had more and more people that have been making the effort to go there. And then they contact me and they're like, Gary, we went there and that was the coolest thing ever. Thank you for telling us about this. And there's a lot of places like that around the world that are amazing, but people just kind of skip them, especially if you're on a cruise ship. There's only so much you can see on a cruise ship. And you're going to see kind of the same stuff everyone does.
Yeah, I completely agree on that. So when it comes to building a community online, because you've built, like you said, you know, whenever you recommend something like this national park that I'm now going to go look up, people visit it and you've built this community of trust. People trust you and they'll go and visit and read and do kind of what you suggest. How would you suggest people who are kind of just getting started in this space, you know, how do they build that authority? And then how do they build that online trust with their community? Like they're living a laptop lifestyle, they're virtual, but how do they still kind of make that human element of trust when it comes to building an online business?
This goes right back to what I talked about before, you know, building authority. You got to walk the walk. You got to do something that you can point to factually and say, this is why I am an authority. So, if you were to be coached, let's say you wanted to become a competitive swimmer and Michael Phelps was going to coach you. Would he, you know, do you think he would know what he's talking about?
Right.
The answer is, yeah, he's Michael Phelps. He's won 23 gold medals. Or Michael Phelps' coach, if he were to coach you. Well, okay, he's a pretty good coach. He coached a guy that had 23 gold medals. But that's a thing they can point to, right? And a lot of people, they do these vague value statements that I don't really like because anybody can say that, right? And if anybody can do it, then it doesn't make you an authority. Authority is something that, you know, you had to have done or few people can't have done. So if someone's listening to this and they're a digital nomad or they're living out of a laptop, you have to start thinking, okay, what do I want to be known for? And what can I point, what have I done? And what can I do in the future? You know, how can I orientate my travels to kind of accentuate that thing that I want to emphasize? And there's different ways to do it. You know, maybe you have a website that just talks about one particular destination. So it's not a, I've been traveling all over the world type thing. You just want to focus on one area. Well, there are different ways you can show authority in that as well. You know, Rick Steves is a really good example. You know, he has a popular radio TV show. He has guidebooks and he always starts out as his radio show by saying, you know, Rick Steves has been traveling to Europe for over 30 years and spends 3 months out of the year in Europe. Right. So he says, I've spent a lot of time there and every year I spend a lot of time there, which is something he can point to show his authority. If you're doing something on Greece, you can simply say, you know, I've been to every province in Greece. You know, maybe I've been there twice. I've been to all of the major islands, all of the major Greek islands. I've been to, you know, however you do it, something that shows a comprehensiveness, a time commitment that you can then point to that someone would say, okay, you probably know what you're talking about.
Right.
And that's really kind of what you have to do. So I'm even a big believer, if you have a travel blog, your travel, absent what you write, absent what you post, absent the photos, your travel itself is content because your travel resume is something you're going to be able to point to show your authority.
Mm. I love that. Gary, I feel like I could pick your brain and talk to you all day, but I want to wrap up the show. I have one more question I want to ask you, but before I do, can you share with all the laptop lifestylers out there where they can follow you online and just hear more about your travels and more of your amazing business wisdom?
You can go to everything-everywhere.com. I am super easy to find online. You can just type in my name. If you can't spell my last name, just type Gary and travel and you'll find me. I'm on pretty much every major social media platform. You're an email marketer. So if you go to my website and subscribe to my email newsletter, I have a 100-page ebook that you can download. that has 100 of my favorite travel photos from the last couple of years.
Ooh, I'm going to link all of this up for you guys in the show notes. So it's going to be really easy for you to download that free ebook, because I'm going to go do that right after we jump off this episode. Oh, Gary, I cannot thank you enough for being on The Laptop Lifestyle. You're a huge inspiration to me, and I cannot wait to dive in more into your content. My last question for you is, what does the laptop lifestyle mean to you?
It means freedom. You know, that's really kind of why I got started to do this to begin with. You know, the freedom to go where you want, when you want, to work when you want, and to do what you want. And I think that anyone who's doing this or wants to do this, that when you brush everything else aside, that's the real reason why you do it.